This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are very excited to welcome to the podcast today Leah Uppi. Leah is the Ralph Miliband Professor of Politics and Philosophy, and she's written several books, including the most recent Indignity, A Life Reimagined. Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brad, and us all.
So the first thing to do is that this is a book that obviously emerges from a personal experience. I actually happen to know a bit about Salonika because one of my colleagues wrote the book on Jewish Salonika, which is actually, we should invite him on, Derek. It's a really interesting book. But how did this story come to be? What made you want to investigate it in addition to your sort of more traditional work on politics and philosophy? What was your entry point for this story? And how do you think it relates to the larger themes in your work?
Well, it started when a relative texted me to say, "Have you noticed your grandmother has become viral on Facebook?" And I went on Facebook and discovered a photo of her that I had never seen before, shared by someone I had never heard before, followed by lots of derogatory comments and allegations. It was a photo of her that was taken in the winter of 1941, a period of her life that I had heard lots of stories about that I had never seen any images because my grandmother told me that all her records from her youth disappeared when the communists arrested my grandfather and took all her belongings. And so it was a mystery of this photograph that I had no idea still existed, followed by all the comments and the allegations that my grandmother might have been a spy. Some people said she was a communist spy, some people said she was a fascist spy, that made me want to track down her story and discover the truth behind the photo and behind her life. Because it raised a lot of questions around dignity. And my grandmother always said that she had a life of ups and downs. Maybe we'll get to talk a little bit about that. But basically, the one thing that she says she retained in all those ups and downs of her life was her dignity. And of course, she was alive when she said this. And the photo, which appeared many years after her death, for me raised the question of who has the right to tell the story of a life and how can you do so in a way that defends or indicates the dignity of someone who is no longer there to do that themselves.
And so that's interesting.
I wonder if before we really get into the book and you're kind of searching for, you know, information about your grandmother and how you that led you on this track, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about this experience, which is, you know, unique to our wonderful social media moment of going online and having people say, "Hey, your grandmother is going viral in a photograph on a, you know, complete stranger's social media page," and people are making, you know, all sorts of derogatory comments about her, and just like, and you had nothing to do with this except that you were alerted to it. Just can you talk a little bit more about what that was like? It's surreal on one level, and yet,
I mean,
that happens now.
What's really interesting is that it was connected to the publication of my other book, Free, in Albania, which had raised also lots of questions, and there were lots of trolling, and people were, it was a very sensitive topic, questions of freedom in the transition from communism to capitalism. And in many ways, my grandmother's photo appeared as a proof to show the public, whatever the public sphere is around Facebook, that this author of Free, which was my previous book, came from a family that had no connection to socialism and somehow was defending socialism in her work. And so it was mainly this kind of judgment, the trial of intentions, of my intentions, but in which my grandmother was dragged. And of course, for me, I've always, my line on trolling has always been that, you know, you, if, as long as you're there to defend yourself and you can resist disinformation, you can try and log off, you can report people. I always believed in freedom of speech, but freedom of speech requires someone who is still alive and active and able to defend themselves and present a counter argument. So even if one takes the most generous line on misinformation and fake news and social media, which is, well, you know, the standard John Stuart Mill line, the truth will prevail so long as there are lots of different takes on it. That requires someone who actively is able to say the truth and to explain their lives. And of course, when the person is dead and they're no longer there, their entire life, their entire legacy is at the mercy of the interpretations that emerge about them after their death. And of course, if you have a descendant or someone who knew you and knows your life, then that descendant has some special responsibility. But in the case of people who have no descendants, you know, their entire legacy is in the hands of unknown strangers. And this is why this question of dignity in life and death is so central to the book.
Right, and there are clearly limit lines. I assume there would be a different argument about Adolf Hitler than, you know, your grandmother, for example, in the relationship of dignity and indignity. So I was hoping we could actually get in and dig in a little more to what do you mean by dignity? I'm an intellectual historian. I'm not a philosopher, but my layperson's understanding is that this has been talked about for a while. So could you talk about, like, what is the exploration of dignity? What do you mean by the concept? Because obviously when you're talking up here in the abstract reality, what's interesting about the book is that you hit the ground in actually writing about someone in real history who's a real historical person in a context. So maybe we could talk about philosophy for a second, then we could hit the ground and talk about how you saw the rubber hitting the road with this particular project.
Yeah, and in philosophical terms, dignity is a concept with a very long history and also strange history, because it begins to circulate in mostly the Roman period, where it's connected to what we would now think of as dignitaries. And the concept of dignitas is connected to status and to the rhetoric of positioning yourself in a certain way. It's mainly a way of posturing, of being in the world, and it's related to character and standing. And then with Christianity, it begins to change a little bit, because this concept of dignitas is connected to human beings being in the image of God. So Imago Dei is the standard way of referring to dignity. That's to say, there's something that singles out humans in this great chain of being that's about a capacity that only they have. And then in the form that interests me most, which is this more secularized Christian, but now secularized conception, it's something that is connected to the capacity of humans to set and pursue moral ends in the world. And so to the will as something that's distinctive and specific to a certain image of the person. And this is also the form in which actually, when I link the philosophical, the moral, the abstract with the particular, it's also the form that someone like my grandmother hang on to this concept as she was trying to navigate this trauma of her life. Was something that she said, you know, I lost everything. I lost wealth and status and power and connections. But the one thing that you never lose, also in traumatic circumstances, also in the middle of great injustice, is dignity as the capacity to preserve your moral integrity. And as I say, this is exactly what gets questioned when the person is no longer there and no longer has the active capacity to preserve their moral integrity, because then it becomes a question of legacy. The question is, dignity is connected with what are the interpretations of that life such that they can vindicate the kinds of motives that the person had as they tried to navigate these difficulties.
And where is the limit case? I mean, I'm just going to bring up Hitler because it's so extreme. Like, someone like that is not worthy of dignity, right? So, like, where is this, or are they? And that would be an interesting, and it is, you know, these vile mass murderers. Where is that line drawn? Obviously, that's not an issue in this particular instance, because you're not talking about a world historical criminal. But I think that I do find the sort of limit case interesting. So how does that play into this notion of dignity or indignity?
Well, I mean, in many ways, dignity is a philosophical ideal of the person at their best. And so in that sense, and it's connected to the capacity of humans to act morally and to follow moral imperatives. But the capacity is a capacity, not the realization of those capacities. And that's exactly the difference between the historical case of someone who does have this capacity, because they are human, they can reason, they can tell what's wrong from what's right, they can tell good from evil, and yet they pursue. Also, because they have freedom of will, they decide to do the wrong thing. And so in that sense, I would say that even someone like Hitler, even the counterparty, nothing evil case, is someone who is capable of positioning themselves morally in the world and has dignity for that reason, but of course don't act on the basis of that principle, choose an alternative principle. And that's also why this is last stage, in a way, when we're thinking about dignity in this transition from the moral to the political. This is why we also need to entrench dignity in legal and political frameworks. So if you think about the centrality of the concept in the United Nations Charter of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, human dignity is inviolable. The German Constitution also has human dignity as one of the founding principles. Of course, if it was something that we could always rely on, and if we could always rely on people to create institutions that reflect dignity, we wouldn't need to entrench and protect it in the law. We need the law precisely because although there is this capacity that we associate to dignity, we also see instances of indignity that need to be defended, and we need institutions for that. So I think this is the relation between the moral and the political in many ways, and what explains this.
Super interesting. And so I want to get into Bookins in a second, but I have another sort of theoretical question. So obviously the two references you use, which were the United Nations and the German Constitution, are like hyper North Atlantic references with like very particular moral contextual context, those two in particular emerging directly from the Holocaust. So in a moment where Western hegemony and North Atlantic hegemony is coming apart, and these universalistic concepts, particularly in the wake of Israel's genocide in Gaza and the United States' and Western world support for it, basically most of the world think is kind of bullshit. Like how are people in the North Atlantic going to lecture other people about dignity or really any moral concept, moral universalistic concept? What do you think about that? Sort of like in those two particular constitutions or frameworks are like in a very particular historical moment that is now like disintegrating in front of our eyes. And then we'll get to the book because this is like not related to the book, but I'm just interested. How do you speak in these sort of like, not you, how does one speak in universalistic frameworks in a universalistic world that no longer exists? And not only that, sort of the lies at the center of that universal framework have since October 7th, you know, really come apart.
Well, I think we can distinguish between the universalist framework and the political context in which the universalist framework gets appropriated and in many ways. A lot of my book is actually about the Ottoman Empire and the relevance of dignity as a concept, even for characters and people who lived in the Ottoman Empire, and the centrality of this idea of the dignity of subjects in the modernization reforms that the Ottoman Empire was shaped by at some point in the turning in the, towards the end of the 19th century. And so I would say that, and actually, if we go back to this United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, the concept of dignity was selected and it's emphasized precisely because there's a lot of cross-cultural references that one way or another appeal to this idea of dignity. And so people coming from different religious, cultural, historical, political backgrounds could actually sign up to this concept as something that was behind the United Nations. Now, of course, you might say the United Nations is just a vehicle of Western imperialist power, but there is also another way of thinking about it, which I think gets to some truth about the United Nations. But there's also another way of thinking about it, which is to say, well, it is actually now one of the very few institutions that we have left where we hear the voices also from the margins and so forth, or from non-Western imperialist powers, where we get a little bit more diversity. So, and, you know, if you think about the history of dignity, politicians or historical figures, characters, movements that appeal to it, I don't think they are exclusively focused and experience dignity in the West and from a Western perspective. As I say in the book, a lot of my stories about the Ottoman Empire is one example where these ideas of the Enlightenment that we think of now as core Western Europe were actually discussed in historical period precisely for their capacity to mobilize social movements, political groups, reforms, and to change the political setup in a very different direction.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll let Derek go. But the Ottoman case is interesting because it's liminal in a sense, you know, like very much particularly in the 19th and early 20th century oriented toward Europe. And then over the course of the 20th century has like different perspectives on like where it sits in quote unquote civilizational history, which is obviously not true. But sorry, Derek, off to you.
Well, I mean, let's get into the book. I mean, you have this, again, sort of surreal, I guess, on some level, experience of your grandmother's photograph and appearing online. You look at the photograph. What did that experience trigger in you to cause you to want to go and research more about her? Talk about what was in the photograph and your, as compared to your recollections of her. You get into this in the book, but what it was that created sort of a curiosity to go do this, follow this line.
Yeah, on the one hand, I'd say this sense of moral resistance. So this idea that there she is, someone who is very important to me and who played a crucial role in my life, while often thought of as a paragon, as a symbol of virtue. And yet there she is, she's no longer able to defend or speak for herself. And she is at the mercy of the trolls and she can't defend herself. And so somehow it triggered in me this almost defensive instinct that I wanted to say something on her behalf. And on the other hand, and this is now a different stance, it's more, so the first one is a moral feeling, is a moral instinct. On the other hand, I had the idea that perhaps because this photo that was there and I had never seen before, perhaps there was also a part of her life that just as I had not seen the photo, I did not know about. And so maybe those people who were circulating her photo, who clearly had access to a part of her life that I didn't know, might have also had access to facts about her life that I didn't know. And so there was a sense in which to defend the dignity of someone, you have to have a truth of this life, or you have to have access to some kind of truth, and you need to be able to go back to the facts and to the source of where those facts are coming from. And on doing further research on the source of the photo, I discovered that it might have been contained in this archive that collects the surveillance reports of victims of communist and communist Albanians. So I went to the archive where I was told that not just the photos of my family, also all the other documents of trial reports or surveillance files would be contained, and that I would be able to piece together this period of her life that was clouded in mystery for me just by looking at these documents and by looking at this evidence.
So you talk in the book about your experience going to Albania, to Tirana, to go to the archive, and you have this, I don't want to say David Brooks-esque, but you do have this encounter with a cab driver, and you know, just I guess
Tom Friedman, Derek. Know your shitty New York Times
columnists. Oh, it's Tom Friedman. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. You're right. It's Tom Friedman who does the cab driver columns. But just the experience of coming back to a place that had changed on one level, and yet, you know, you're hearing from people who live there that nothing has changed. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like, just encountering this place?
Well, so for me, what was really interesting was the first thing is whenever you go, I've been living abroad now, away from Albania for many years. And of course, at one level, you think you're returning home to a place that is very familiar. But then on the other hand, because places change, implying they're not really the same place that you left, and you are also not the same person that people would recognize and remember. And so it was the experience of someone who returns and who is being told abroad that they are from somewhere else. But when they return to that somewhere else, they're also an outsider in many ways. And so it's the return of the outsider who is constantly faced with the status of being an outsider, or the migrant rather, who is constantly faced with this experience of being outsiders wherever they go, because it's in host societies. It's because they were not born there. And if it's in the country where you were born, it's because you don't live there and you're not really in touch with the changes. And the experience is also, in the case of my search in the archives, an interesting one, because in a lot of countries like Albania that are shaped by these historical injustices, there is a sense that if you return to the archive, you will find the truth about what happened to your family. And through that access to the truth, you'll be able to find reconciliation. But of course, there is a very cynical stance, which is the stance of a cab driver whom I meet in my first effort to go to the archive, who says, you know, there are, and I say, I'm going to the former Secret Service archives. And he replies saying, there are no formers here. It's all the same people. Nothing's changed.
Right, it's always right. It's ever just the was. Same and stuff,
so,
yeah.
And so this deep cynicism around the very effort to untangle historical injustice and to find the truth and to hopefully build a process of reconciliation by going back to the truth relies, of course, on the break between the present and the past, which may not be there and which many people also perceive to not be there because they see the continuation of structures, of the old structures in present structures. So they see the continuation in personnel and the people who work for the state, who represent the state. And in many ways, they also see ideology and propaganda shaping both the old institutions and the new ones. So there's this deep nihilistic and cynical perspective on change that is a very important component of trying to untangle this process and of recovering the truth in this context.
So I think it might be worth it to get into the story of your grandmother directly, her childhood in Ottoman Salonika, her move to Albania, and sort of the larger themes that, you know, this expresses about the history of post-imperial decline, or I guess imperial decline, not post-imperial decline, but imperial decline in the first half of the 20th century. So what did you discover? What did you discover about your grandmother? And what does it say about these larger themes you explore?
Well, so she grew up in Salonika that had just become independent from the Ottoman Empire, but she was born when the Ottoman Empire was still around. And the Salonika of her youth was a very cosmopolitan, multicultural entity where the largest groups in the city were Sephardic Jews, and then there were Albanians, Greeks, Turks, Bulgarians, Armenians. And so it was a very vibrant...
And so many Sephardic Jews that you've heard of, like Hank Azaria, you know, have... literally so many Sephardic Jews come from Salonika. It's wild.
It was one of the most important centers. And actually, my grandmother grew up speaking Ladino and going to French school with a number of children from actually the Sephardic Jewish community. And it was a very vibrant, important both trade and political center of the Ottoman Empire. But of course, at the time in which she was growing up, this was all beginning to crumble because the World War I ended, the Ottoman Empire collapsed. And as part of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, there was a forced population exchange between Greece and Turkey, which began to fundamentally change the character of the city. So more than a million refugees from Asia Minor, Greek refugees from Asia Minor, came back to Greece and in particular settled in Salonika. Hundreds of thousands of Turks, Muslims from Greece had to go back to Turkey. And there was this process of beginning of the nation state, which is the principle of homogenization of a city that had to comply with this new nation state principle that became the principle that would organize political life from then on, not just in the Balkans, but Europe more generally. In the end of World War I, the Versailles Treaty was this idea of nationalities being the basic organizational principle of political life. And this put huge pressure on minorities and forced everyone with this question of what are you? So people who had answered the question of identity, the question of what they were in very different ways, along very different lives in the imperial context, had to come up with answers which were very unfamiliar and very disturbing and often with tragic implications because they no longer fit it into this new nation state principle. And so the politics of the 20s and 30s is really a politics of, as I say, emerging nationalism and scapegoating of minorities as a way of resolving the conflicts of globalization, the conflicts that connected to the collapse of empires. It was a politics in which the Wall Street crash and the financial crisis that ensued from that made every state retrench and I'm not finding a word now in English, but basically made every state return to an isolationist politics where you have trade wars and tariff wars and competition between blocs. And as a result of all that, as I say, the politics of the 30s that she experienced was a deeply exclusionary one with often many parallels with the present.
What parallels do you... Well, actually, Derek, before we move on, I am curious about what parallels... You see, because obviously I'm a 20th century guy, so post 45 guy. So what parallels do you see to what's going on today or what happened later in the century? I mean, this is a region that is, you know, been classically, what would be the word, be fucked over by larger empires for the last several centuries. So if you could talk a little bit about the parallels that you've discovered.
Well, one of them is the politics of deglobalization. So I think the cosmopolitan multicultural setup of empires was a very different way of thinking about politics, different way of organizing relationships between communities and different ways of in which cultures coexisted with each other. And I would say that the politics of the 20s and 30s is very similar to what we are now going through in terms of this departure away from cosmopolitanism, from multiculturalism. It was a politics of collapse of international institutions. So the League of Nations, which was one of the institutions that had emerged after World War I, as a way of securing international cooperation and international agreements between states, security, trade, also international institutions also begin to crumble as a result of this politics of the 20s and the 30s. States more and more move away from international cooperation as a basic principle, and you begin to return to this idea that we need to be self-sufficient, we need to make our own country great again. And this is very standard pattern. You have this politics of scapegoating of minorities that emerges as a result of that. The pressures of globalization, the pressures of financial crisis are such that the nation states by themselves can't really contain and respond to all the conflicts of the time. And as a way of making sense of that, begin to say, well, it's the problem of particular minorities that don't integrate and they don't fit. In the 1930s, this was the paradigmatic example of anti-Semitism, which starts with this idea. Well, it had already started in the 19th century, but really escalates more and more. And it's this idea that Jewish people don't fit and they don't want to integrate. They have their own practices. They follow their own cultural demands. They don't really fit with what everyone else is doing. And of course, it's in the first instance a response to political and economic conflict, but that gets culturalized and becomes a cultural conflict as a result of that. And I think you see then trade wars, tariff wars, and eventually the escalation into full-blown war, because this project that each of these countries wants to become great, well, they can't become all great at the same time. And so eventually the conflicts come to a head and they start fighting each other. I see a lot of parallels, in particular in connection to migration debates right now, and to how migrants are often being spoken at as members, representatives of particular groups that don't fit, that undermine the coherence and the strength of the welfare state, or that undermine liberal values. And so there is very much an emerging discourse on the outsider as that which threatens cognition, and this idea that membership is what we need to resolve before we can actually resolve any of the other conflicts. And I think this has very eerie parallels to the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah, and it's it is interesting, because I think both things are happening in the United States and United Kingdom, but from very different contexts. I mean, the United Kingdom is like post-imperial at this point. It shouldn't be a member of the Security Council. It's a very weak country that essentially relies on the United States based on like a cultural racialized affinity going back to the late 19th century. And in the United States, you have an incredible xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment, but at least in the 2024 election, you saw a lot of members of quote-unquote minority groups vote for Trump. So there's something like weird happening here with like a multi-ethnic society that is organized around citizenship, that is racialized in terms of whiteness and religiosized in terms of Christianity, but is also more porous just due to the nature of the United States. So it's interesting to see also the differences. I was wondering if you saw anything similar vis-a-vis, and this is probably less important for the United Kingdom, but the United States and China, because that's really the conversation that dominates in this country when you're looking at geopolitical antagonism. I obviously in Europe, there's a lot of discussion about migration, particularly from the quote unquote Islamic world, however you want to define that. And it's been going on for a while, whether you're talking about Gastarbeiter in Germany or Pakistanis in the UK. But it's a little bit of a different tenor here. So the answer might be no, because you're sitting in a different context. But I was wondering if you saw any parallels between how the US discusses China or the West as a whole.
Well, I mean, I think what you see, the parallel is the form that great power politics takes. And then the great powers, the names of the great powers are contingent and they change because the historical circumstances change. But for me, really, what's interesting is this combination of the dynamic of international institutions that develop when powers come together. And then on the other hand, the pressures of globalization, financial crisis, and here it is that then bring to unmake these international institutions and then bring to different kind of great power politics and to different alliances between states and different competition between different economic blocs or hegemony, both political and economic. And so I think this context of the breakup of empires is a little bit of an example of how the making and unmaking of great power politics, and of course, as I say, changes historical and contingent, which are the great powers. But the dynamic, I think, in the context of pressures from capitalism, from globalization, is rather similar.
Right. And this is the question, then we'll move on for the 21st century. And you could respond to this or not, is can you have international institutions that aren't based on a hegemonic framework? Because as I'm sure you know, China wanted to interact in the Western international institutions. And the US is like, oh no, we're the only ones who are allowed to manipulate the WHO or whatever it would be for our own purposes. So then the question coming for the next century is really, can you have the sorts of UN frameworks that are genuinely multipolar? I mean, I don't think they'll ever be multipolar in the sense that the smaller nations are going to have as much of a say as the bigger nations, but can you have at least China in a legitimate way helping to direct an international framework that is actually abided by? I'm not sure, but I think this is a larger question. But you can respond to that or not.
Well, for me, very briefly, there's two ways of thinking about globalization. One is political globalization, which requires emerging international institutions with a sense of respect. And so there's this ideal of reciprocity and cooperation and equality and freedoms as everyone should abide by these values and we should have international institutions that reflect these values. And on the other hand, you have economic globalization, which forces monopolies and sort of forces certain power structures to concentrate and to develop and forces economic interests to then fight pressures and to obtain this position of advantage for themselves. So I think it's this competition between, on the one hand, the principles on which we organize, the global market is organized, which is more or less capitalism, and the tendencies of capitalism to lead to antagonism and competition and to a society where it's really hard for states to actually build structures of solidarity or cooperation with each other. And on the other hand, the demand for political representation at a global level, which pushes you in the opposite direction. I think for me, it's really between the tension between those two forces. And again, that's something that you also see the early 20th century, where you see imperialism emerging as a product of states that need to defend certain economic interests based in their countries.
So, Derek, I'm sorry, I got one more. So are we doomed because capitalism has won? I mean, like, I have to, let's just put my cards on the table. This is a very...
reaching the climax of the interview halfway through. Yeah,
we'll go back to the book. But like, one of the sort of themes of this show, if you take a realistic perspective, or one might say cynical or pessimistic, I mean, this is where I say that Fukuyama was right. He was wrong about the domination of liberalism, but he was right about the end of history and that capitalism has essentially permeated the entire globe. I think China's capitalist. I think Russia's capitalist. I think the United States is capitalist. I don't think there's an alternative political economic framework. So in that sense, I think Fukuyama was right. And it just seems that the pressures and the logics of capitalism do make the type of political organization that you and I think want, the sort of humanistic internationalism, impossible. So there's not even a challenge to capitalism right now to the degree where that we're cooking the planet. So this is now really far from the book, and we're going to return to the book after this one. But I was wondering if you could maybe go on in this. I want to hear more about what you think about the challenge that capitalism poses to this type of framework that we'd like to see happen.
Well, I mean, I don't think capitalism is a contingent mode of production. So I don't think it's a fact of nature that has always been there and will always be there. And I think there is, it's very important to think about the politics of fighting capitalism. And I think that, yeah, I would say, yes, it's true that in some ways we are doomed. I personally think that for as long as there is capitalism, it's very hard to think of international cooperation that takes a form that is not competitive and antagonistic and that doesn't develop a side of human nature that doesn't sit well with this idea of solidarity and reciprocity. But on the other hand, I also don't think that there is anything intrinsic about that, because much as there is structure, there is also agency within structures. And there is always one of the themes around actually dignity, and one of the things that I emphasize in the book, is that there is always the possibility of thinking differently and of acting differently and of not complying. There's a possibility of human will shaping events and circumstances, in particular when it takes a political form and when it's individualistic, when it's limited to the individual, as in the case of my grandmother in the book, that's very difficult. But when you think about it as will, as collective will, and politics as something that emerges from many wills coming together, then I don't think that capitalism is a fact of nature. And so I think that there is a way of thinking about society and about markets and about social life that is different. And in that sense, I don't think we are doomed. So I'd say there is a difference between the historical perspective and the philosophical perspective. So the historical perspective would say these are the facts of the world that we're grappling with. But then there is also a moral way of thinking about it and an alternative. And that outlook, I think it's very important to preserve and remind ourselves, because otherwise we end up with a very deep cynicism and pessimism about the future.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about, and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too, but it's worth it. And it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com. betterhelp.com/thenation. That's betterhelp.com/thenation.
So, if we're not doomed, I would
let's assume like no to go for back. The purposes
let's
of this interview.
No for now, yeah, for at least the next few minutes. I wanted to go back to the story of your grandmother. So, one of the things that was really fascinating to me is she makes the decision in 1936 at the age of 18 to go off to Tirana for an 18-year-old, and I'm the parent of an 18-year-old, so I'll say. Yes, she's an adult, but I want to think of her as a child because I still think of my child as a child. Like to make that decision in 1936 as a woman, as an 18-year-old woman, to go to a new place in a country that is barely older than she is, you know, is 24 years old at that point. Talk a little bit about what went into that and what her experience was.
Well, it was partly a decision that was forced by the historical circumstances. And so partly under pressure from this emerging nationalist politics that raised this question of identity and asked all these different groups, what are you? And in her case, because she came from an Albanian family, even though she'd never been to Albania before, she was told that she was Albanian. She came at home, they spoke Albanian as well as French, which was the language of the aristocracy. Somehow the answer to this question became, I'm going to go back to Albania. And so she went to Albania, which she'd never been before, as an 18-year-old, thinking that that's where she would find the country where she always belonged. And of course, she goes to Albania and she realizes that it's not where she always belonged because she's different from the Albanians that have always lived there. And so she's also an outsider, a little bit like me when I returned to Albania now as a migrant. You're always an outsider because you haven't been there for a very long time. So it was in part this decision triggered by the circumstances, by the history and by the politics of the time, which is the kind of decision that a lot of migrants are also faced with right now when they perceive, you know, it's not that you're actively, even if you're, let's say, a regular migrant, you're not deported. No one is telling you to go. But when the circumstances become hostile, you feel, well, maybe I would be better off somewhere else where there isn't resentment and hostility. I remember in the UK during Brexit, many East European citizens left precisely because it was such an important part of the anti-Brexit campaign to talk about, you know, the Romanians and the Poles and the way they were taking up resources from the state, that they felt they made the voluntary decision to move, even though they hadn't been forced to move. The politics became such that they didn't feel safe anymore living in the UK. And in her case, it was the same, except that she moved to Albania in this very in 1930s, where this was a very tense time for all of Europe. It was a clash between socialists, liberals, fascists. The Spanish Civil War was starting. And it was a time where all these different historical and political projects, all of them made claims on the dignity of the people. And if you were someone who asked themselves, okay, what does it mean to live in a society that respects that dignity? You found yourself at the mercy of all these conflicts, of all these clashes that somehow answered this question very, very differently. And she gets caught in the middle of, and a lot of the book is about the ways in which these human individual lives get caught into these clashes between macro forces.
So let's talk about her story. What happens to her? How do things proceed over the course of the 40s? And then we could get into any of the larger themes that, I mean, it raises a ton of themes that surveillance, nationalism, obviously dignity and indignity. How does her life proceed?
So she moves to Albania as an 18-year-old. She begins to work in the office of the prime minister. This was a particularly liberal prime minister at the time in Albania. And then very quickly, she meets my grandfather, who was a socialist and who had been studying in France and had been mobilized in the Popular Front, which was the last wave, the last kind of swan song of leftist internationalism, where the socialists and the communists came together to fight the fascists. And there was this real effort to support the Popular Front in France and also then to support the Spanish Republicans. And so he was involved in this internationalist politics of the 1930s. But he was the son of a fascist politician and someone who actually became a collaborator and became the head of the provisional government that was responsible for them surrendering the sovereignty of Albania to Italian fascists when they invaded the country in 1939. So Albania gets invaded by the fascists in 1939. Very quickly, the war, World War II, starts. The Nazis then come to Albania, and as part of the fight against the fascists, British intelligence services come to Tirana to support the anti-fascist resistance. Both, actually, in this case, it was English, but there were also Americans working in the Balkans to try and encourage the fascist, anti-fascist resistance. My grandfather came into contact with these British intelligence officers who at the same time were also supporting the communist movement. And that's why when World War II ended and the communists came to power and emerged as the victorious force after World War II, there was a purge of the social democratic elements. And so her husband, my grandfather, was sent to prison for having come to contact with British intelligence officers as part of the purge of the sort of, as I say, radical democratic but not communist elements of the left. And she ended up deported and a single mother, and a file of her was opened in the Secret Service in the Secret Service branch of the Interior Ministry. And a lot of the reconstruction of that part of her life in the book comes from reading those files, intelligence reports, diplomatic documents, exchanges, the files to do with the British diplomatic service in the Tirana and so on. So, and I forgot to say, yeah, my grandfather was in prison for 15 years at that point. So all his trial documents were also in the Secret Service archive.
So this has been a question that particularly historians have been wrestling with it a long time, which is basically using these archives of state in order to reconstruct lives of not even always, but let's just broad term, anti-statist critics or critics of the regime, to say the least. So I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that methodological choice, because that relates directly to dignity and indignity, essentially, you know, using the files of the regime in order to illuminate your grandmother and your grandfather's story.
And if I can actually piggyback on that, just the limitations in general of trying to construct or reconstruct a life based on this type of source material, like that you run into just the basic, even if you're, you know, even if it's not a question of is the state a reliable source on, you know, somebody who's you know, considered to be, you know, acting against it or that type of thing. It's just a very limiting way of looking at somebody, and you have to, there's a lot of gaps that are left to fill in, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's two ways of thinking about dignity there. One is to think of dignity in connection to truth and to presume that the truth is found in the archive. And then you go to these archives and you realize very quickly that there is only a truth to find, that you can trust the mechanism through which truth is transmitted. And what you also discover is that there is an authority that has ordered the facts in a certain way so as to affirm a certain story about their own purpose of being there, what kind of authority it is. So in the case of the Albanian surveillance archives, you realize very quickly that a lot of these files contain information that is not very accurate, especially if you know the person. You realize it's either underreporting or overreporting, sometimes underreporting because the surveillance officers developed a kind of sympathy with their victims. And so they knew that the more they wrote about them, the more likely they would be to cause problems. And so they would say either false things or just try and limit the information. Or sometimes they overreported because they were very zealous officials who wanted, you know, a promotion or wanted to report at the end of the day. And so in each of these cases, you realize that the archive can only be trusted if you can trust the authority that interprets these facts in a certain way. And this wasn't just limited for me to the Albanian archive. So this is speaking about the archive in general. When I went to Greece to search the Ottoman Empire, I was told there is no Ottoman Empire evidence. This is modern Greece. This is the story of the archive is told all from the point of view of the Greek nation state, which wanted to give you an account. For example, if you're searching the history of Salonika, we're very keen to make sure that we get a sense of Salonika as predominantly a Greek city. And so all the different minorities, you know, the Jewish or the Albanians or the Bulgarians, they are progressively erased from the archive because they don't fit with the story that the archive is trying to tell about itself as, or about the city as this nation, Greek, homogenic Greek city made of predominant Greeks and so on. So this is why the evidence around the period that's no longer captured by the archive is very hard to reconstruct. Or you can think about patriarchy. So you try and search for a woman and you're told, well, women weren't even juridical subjects until very recently. And so there's very little evidence there. There are very few records. So in the end, it becomes really interesting because the question of the archive is not only what it contains and what it offers you in a positive, but also what it doesn't tell. What are the silences? What is it obscuring? What is it not saying? Because it doesn't fit into the story that the archive wants to tell you. So if you think about dignity as pure actual truth, it may well be that the archive is not really giving you a truth. It's giving you a truth from its own perspective, from a certain interpretation. And this is why the book then becomes also a methodological reflection around the, how can you reconstruct the truth that is lost in the archive, or a truth that the archive tries to exclude, or a truth that the power structure is constantly trying to marginalize or to conceal somehow. And that's where I go and try to fictionalize with, as I say, with the help of imagination, you try to reconstruct and you try to give voice to the silences of the archive. You try to reconstruct the kinds of things that the archive doesn't contain. But of course, I also think I should emphasize that when you fictionalize, when you imagine, you're not just imagining, you know, out of the blue, just in your room, thinking about what might have Slonica looked like in the 1920s and 30s. All of that reimagining is also based on historical evidence. It's just that the nature of the evidence is much more fragmented and much more piecemeal. And so if you're searching the person, it may be that you don't find all the information that you need around one particular person. But what you find is lots of other lives that come together, and that a more literary effort can bring together in a way, in such a way as to construct a more coherent story of a life that is shaped by these historical forces. So for me, go on.
Well, I just think this would be a good time to talk about narrative and narrativity, and sort of the relationship between reconstruction and what you're doing as a historian slash philosopher, and the types of narratives that are going on today. I mean, particularly with artificial intelligence, I mean, one can look at that and be like, that's not coming out of nowhere. It's coming from the entirety of human, the written word, you know, it's also all this criticism is essentially nonsense, and everyone's just being a Luddite. So I was wondering if you could, because I think you talk about that in the book a little bit in terms of surveillance and those things. So could you relate what you just talked about to these larger themes of narrativity and knowledge creation, and one of the worst terms I think ever created, misinformation and disinformation, which is total nonsense and has basically just been seized by liberal NGOs to replace the war on terror, but that's a story for another day. You could talk a little bit about these larger themes.
Well, I mean, for me, one of the most interesting questions that was raised by actually going to these archives is you see this life that is based on surveillance document, and you can clearly put together very accurate day-to-day reconstruction of the everyday movements of my grandmother or all these subjects of the archive. And surveillance there is what has the records of that life. And if you think about contemporary surveillance, I was thinking as I was in these archives, I was always thinking which my descendants might want to at some point piece together my life based on all the digital traces that I've left, which are much more accurate than actually what there is about my grandmother, which was still analog. And so there was always a power and an agent and a human that was putting together this information. But in our case, when you think about digital surveillance, there is an element of impersonality, and there is still, as you said, a power and a force, and there is a structuring element there as well, and a story that gets told about all of us that can be reconstructed with the base of digital traces that we leave online. Or, you know, I sometimes these archival documents, they really look like prehistoric Google Maps, where you're thinking about, yeah, the subject was at 5:25 in this location, and then 5:20 in this other location. And you could reconstruct. But then, of course, it also raises the question of dignity, because you realize that there is this exactly impersonality, and the way in which power shapes lives in that sense makes you question how much of your dignity can actually just rest in those facts about your life. And what does it take to rescue and to tell the story of that life in a different way from how it constructed by just looking at the evidence, by just looking at the data? And as I say, it's not that the files, or in our case, surveillance, doesn't tell you a story. It's also a perspective. So this is why maybe this word misinformation is misleading. It's rather information from a particular perspective. And the question is, from which perspective has that information been put together? And of course, in the case of my grandmother, it was the information of a communist state. In our case, it's the information that the markets need and that certain companies need to flourish and to continue to make profit. In that sense, the personality, the individuality of the subject under surveillance is irrelevant, because we're not a threat, any one of us, for being under surveillance. Well, unless, you know, we need a job and someone goes and checks the social media evidence about you. And then in that case, it also becomes personal, as it was in those days. But most of the time, it's anonymous, it's impersonal, it's a structure that operates in a certain way, but still takes away the dignity of the subjects in operating in exactly that way, because you are a mere data point. You are just a vehicle to the collection of information and a vehicle for someone to make profit, in this case, a company that you will, you maybe don't even know which company it is and how it operates, but you are there, your life is there, and it's instrumental to another goal emerging. And in, as in the case of my grandma, her life was instrumental to another goal. It's just that the goal in that case was the maintaining of power by a communist party. In our case, it's just the existence and the continued existence of certain capitalist relations that make profit based on those lives.
So what I hear you saying is that we've all essentially become objects of larger, more powerful, oftentimes capitalist, oftentimes imperialist forces. In so doing, we've been denied fundamental aspects of our humanity. We're anonymized, and we've also been used without our consent, and therefore we've been swimming in a stream of indignity. So as we come to the end of the interview, I was just wondering, how I'm not looking for a political program, but what would even a seizure of our dignity look like? We're recording this on an app on the computer. Someone's monitoring this at some point. If we started talking about couches, I'd start getting advertisements for couches. It just seems like the Marxist, the literal, as in Karl Marx, fear that we would become totally alienated, totally objectified, has essentially come true. And so I was wondering, like, where do we go from here? It does seem to some degree, I understand your point about structure and agency, and obviously this is one of the fundamental things that people have been talking about since the Enlightenment. It does seem like the structure, if in each historical moment there are different relations between those two things, it seems like structure is really dominant right now. This is why I think, for example, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos want to go to space, right? Andrew Carnegie wanted to control the Earth. I feel like even Elon Musk feels like he can't control what's going on. Even he, to some degree, is objectified to structures larger than himself. And that's essentially how I'm viewing things right now. And I was wondering if maybe you could comment on that, or like how, if feel free or not to, and then we could talk about like what would even seizing dignity look like. It's not becoming a monk or an anchorite, right? That's just total retreat from the world. But it also seems like there's a very limited sphere of potential agency, to be honest. It doesn't really seem like we're agentive forces in the same way we were at previous moments in human history. And I think that explains the type of thing you were talking about earlier, this like return with a V ideology, which MAGA is an element of, the nationalizing anti-migrant xenophobia, I think, is an element of. It's a longing for a moment when you felt like you controlled your fucking life. And now none of us feel like we control our lives. I mean, we're academics, you know, I don't control where I live. If some random search committee decides to grace me with an interview, maybe I'll change. But like, I certainly don't feel like I'm an agent in my own life, and I'm pretty privileged. So I don't know. There's a lot there, but I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I mean, so I think at one level, absolutely, and this is part of the message of the book and part of what I think, which is that there is mostly indignity. What we see is mostly indignity. It's violations of dignity and in many ways also violations of this capacity for agency. And we see mostly heteronomy rather than autonomy. So this, you don't get to choose which ends you pursue, or if you do know them, you can't pursue them because it's so hard, because the world is constantly conspiring against you. And so a lot of my thinking is actually about this oppression that in capitalist circumstances takes a more horizontal form. It's not vertical oppression. So it's not oppression by the party or the communist state or the elite apparatus. It is oppression by anonymous impersonal forces that mainly seek profit, and we are all have acquiesced because that is a world in which we work and the world in which we live. And so if we have in this conversation, we're having it structured by those very forces that we want to resist. But for me, it's also really important to think that actually in the moments in history where there have been openings, it's because politics and alternative projects managed to consolidate and emerge. And so, yes, there is constant pressure by structures, but there are also openings where there are alternative political projects that push back against the structure. And that's where you see agency and you see the possibility for greater agency. One of the, I think, misfortunes of our time is that we now think of agency mostly as individual. And in that sense, this is really the result of neoliberalism, where the individual is sovereign. When we think about solutions, we always think about what can the individual do? How can they fight against the structure? And they mostly can't, because an individual cannot by themselves. But they can, I think, if they participate and they manage to create collective projects of alternative thinking, of alternative questioning. And that's where I would say the role of just one last word on this and then we can continue. That's where I say the role of intellectuals is what is the point of writing books or having podcasts or creating these alternative spaces for discourse? It's exactly to remind people, but it doesn't have to be that way. And there's another way of looking at facts, looking at the ordering of facts and looking at dignity. And it's a more creative process in a creative intervention.
Well, I mean, I agree. This is the real question, right? Are those sorts of collectivities actually not imaginable? They're imaginable. We're imagining them right now. Are they possible? I guess I would frame it a little differently. I don't think it's like an ideological effect of neoliberalism. I don't think like if we all had the right consciousness, then we would all of a sudden be able to collectivize. I mean, look at it right now. I mean, this is, I have a book coming out on this. Like I think that state structure has emerged in a way in the democratic quote unquote world that essentially denies mass political action by design. And I think that we've talked a lot about capitalism, but I also think like, you know, augment Marx with Engels, there's a security element there as well. There's a sort of Weberian sort of collective violence. But what was possible in 1945 is just not possible in the same way today with like drones and these types of violences. So this is, Derek and I were doing an episode on ICE recently, and Derek made a quote unquote joke is like, when are domestic drone strikes going to start and things like that. And so
I was not joking.
Yeah, I know. He's not joking. I said joking quotes. I mean, I think, so this is really the question, right? Are the sorts of collective possibilities that define the era of industrial modernity possible in the same way in a post-industrial modernity? And I genuinely don't know. I think that, at least in the United States, you probably have to see much more of a regime collapse than we actually see. And then this gets into larger questions. I think you're unlikely to see that because something that has been quote-unquote solved, at least for now, is like cheap calories, and which wasn't true whenever, as I'm sure you know, whenever you look at an actual revolution, they're almost always preceded by food riots, whether you're talking about 1789 or 1917 or other ones throughout the world. And so, I mean, I think you raise really the question. I agree that is what we need to see, but I think there's a reason we haven't seen it, I guess is what for a long period.
Please. Yeah, I completely agree with that. But then on the other hand, I would say we shouldn't give up on democracy before democracy gives up completely on us. And so I think, you know, to the extent that there is representative politics, to the extent that there are political parties, social movements, making claims on a public sphere on behalf of certain ideas and trying to kind of shape collective will in one way or another, I think we need to think about what spaces there are and what we could do with those spaces and start with them and then not give up prematurely on them. Because I think it risks becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy when we say, oh, there is no agency, there's no possibility for agency. There is a risk that an overly pessimistic look turns out to be just defeating. And so for me, this is why a lot of it is about, and actually not just in the book, but in my work, it's about the relation between imagination and reality. And so what are the possibilities of imagination in rethinking reality and thinking about the constraints of politics on the one hand, but also the openings that certain conflicts offer to try and think the world differently and organize different principles. So I think, and I say, let's say representative politics, democratic politics, yes, it's true, political parties are mostly captured by capital. It's true, most of them behave like cartels, and it's true that most of them are at the mercy of elites, but they're not completely like that. They're not 100% like that. And so until they are just 100% like that, and then we have to think about alternative, you know, mobilizations, we have to think about revolution, we have to think about different other types of resistance. For now, we need to somehow take advantage of whatever openings there are in democratic politics in different countries and begin to build an alternative agenda and an alternative narrative and an alternative diagnosis and solution to the problems of the world. And in that sense, I think without agency, without some belief in agency, all of that becomes meaningless. That's why I completely take your point. And it's not that, you know, you don't have to be either optimistic or pessimistic. It's more when you're thinking about the future, the question becomes, what is the most productive outlook? And it seems with an outlook that says it's too change, it's too difficult. It's, while on the one hand, it's important because it's important as a caution. On the other hand, if it's taken too far, it risks being self-defeating.
And this is why Derek and I say join the Democratic Party, which has just caved on the shutdown. So what, our health premiums are going to go up 4,000,000% now? Okay. Leah, do you have any final thoughts? We really appreciated you being on the show. Everyone, check out Indignity, A Life Reimagined, a really fascinating book. But I wanted to give you the final word if you had anything to add.
Actually, nowadays, I think we've covered a lot of it.
Perfect. Perfect.
Don't give up all the imagination.
We're not doomed. Don't give up. But
leave your goon cave. Don't stay in your goon cave.
That's right. Hope comes in the kind of imaginative and redemptive power.
Yes, it does. Hope we can't believe in. Thank you very much, everyone. Again, that's Indignity: A Life Reimagined. Check out the book, Leah. We really appreciate it. We'd love to have you back again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.